Welcome to this interview. I'm Megan Gibson, your conference co-host. Today, I'm speaking with Eliza VanCort. After enduring traumatic kidnappings as a child and then surviving a life-altering bicycle accident as an adult, Eliza VanCort has become a number one best-selling author, renowned speaker, top podcaster, and sought-after consultant. Utilizing her academic expertise and decades as an acting instructor, Eliza transforms audiences' lives. Her first book is A Woman's Guide to Claiming Space, Stand Tall, Raise Your Voice, and Be Heard. Eliza VanCort, thank you so much for being with us today.
I'm really excited to be there. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited.
So you had a bit of an unconventional childhood and a major brain injury. And from reading your book, it's clear both of those experiences informed the way that you carry yourself in the world and how you help people claim space. So I would love it if you could just start by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Well, you know, my journey to claiming space was definitely not I just decided one day to claim space. It was actually a pretty hard journey. I was born with a mom who is, by all accounts, an absolutely brilliant, wonderful mother. And then when I was 4 and a half, she became paranoid schizophrenic. And she ended up kidnapping me 3 times and taking me across the country by truck one time from truck stop to truck stop to truck stop from New York to California. And what happened on that trip really made me start to conflate invisibility with safety. I thought if I could just be invisible, then I would be safe. And of course, being invisible isn't safe. It's really, really dangerous. And for a long time, I kind of clawed my way out of that. I had a lot of support from a lot of wonderful people. I got really good at teaching other people how to claim their space, but I didn't really do it until I was hit by a car while riding my bike. And the process of rebuilding my communication brick by brick and really observing human behavior made me start to understand what claiming space really was. And that was the beginning of me writing my book.
I'm so glad you shared that. Thank you. And the reason that I really asked you is because I think for most people, they know that they need to claim space. They know that they need to do some inner work in order to project on the outside what they feel like their potential is on the inside. But for most people, they can't realize the stakes of it and how important it is. And there's not any urgency. So how do we create that urgency and importance within ourselves without receiving a major head injury?
Yeah, I always joke, like, it's kind of good to not have to be hit by a car. That's a really interesting question, and nobody's ever asked me that. I think, unfortunately, you know, the urgency to claim space doesn't just happen because one day you figure it out. Usually there's some sort of precipitating event that makes it happen. And not only that, but our society, at least when it comes to women and certain targeted groups, really rewards us for being small. We get a lot of positive feedback for making ourselves small. So to decide that you're willing to give that up and all that that entails to start claiming space usually takes a pretty big life event.
And you mentioned earlier that it reminds me of what you said about your childhood and invisibility equaling safety. Yeah. And I can really relate to that. At the beginning, the first like 20 years of my career, I was really proud of the fact that I would get invited into rooms that I didn't feel like I necessarily belonged in yet. Like I didn't have the title or the authority or the experience to get in those rooms, but I knew that I got invited into them because I knew how to be quiet. I knew how to behave. I knew how to be a chameleon in different environments. And I thought this was like this amazing, great skill set. I was furniture, right? Like, and so yeah. Moving out of that space of being small in order to be included. We're kind of going off on a tangent here, but I could really relate to what you were saying about invisibility equaling safety.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you've had trauma, you've learned to become invisible to survive. And so to undo that is difficult. And a lot of us become, as a compensatory strategy, people pleasers, you know, but as my dear friend, and you've read my book, Kim Munson Burke, brilliant woman, always says, she always says, people pleasers will kill you and cry over your dead body. I'm so sorry that you're dead. I'm so sad that I killed you. And I think when you're a people pleaser, you are still in trauma mode. You're still working so hard to make sure that you're safe, that you'll say anything and do anything to keep everybody happy. And that doesn't serve you, but it also doesn't serve the people around you. And in the long run, I think it hurts everyone. I think that it's harder to not be a people pleaser and to not be a chameleon. But in the long run, the rewards are just so huge.
Absolutely. Yeah. And as we're talking about, you know, toxic relationships, I wanted the trajectory of your book is we're going kind of in a different order than the way that your book goes. And I did that on purpose because I think, you know, in toxic relationship, the first relationship that we have to speak about is the one that we have with ourselves. And then we can kind of expand out to how that shows up with others, right? But it starts internally and we come by it honestly through our relationships with other people in our childhood, like you described mm-hmm. with your mother. And then we just kind of carry that sometimes subconsciously into our adulthood. But one of the things that I really related to was your talking about anti-mentors, which I had never heard that term before. So how did you come up with that term? And can you tell us what it is?
Anti-mentors just sort of came to me because I was thinking about mentors and I was thinking about all the, you know, people you always hear about mentors. But when you really start to talk to people and you talk about their greatest influences, often it's, oh, I had this person in my life who eviscerated me and it changed everything. And then one day I found this mentor and they helped me, or a therapist or whatever. And so I started journaling. I don't know, you know, I'm not a big fan of journaling saving you, but you know, whatever it is you did. But it's the anti-mentor that we spend a lot of our lives trying to crawl out from under the pile of mythology that they pour on us. And so I realized, you know, you can't talk about building community if you don't talk about the people in your community that are poisoning it. And so I started to really think about anti-mentors and all of the, I mean, I've had so many people I've spoken to, interviewed, taught, mentored. And it was just the amazing thing is the things that I list in the book that make you an anti-mentor and how you deal with it, it doesn't matter what race you are, what gender you are. It doesn't matter, you know, what demographic you come from. Everyone seems to relate to it, unfortunately.
Absolutely. And those relationships come in all different forms, right? They can be familial, they can be friends, they can be coworkers, people in your community, people in your, you know, circles of faith. Those anti-mentors can come from all sides, right?
Totally. And the worst part about anti-mentors is they're not just random teachers. You know, they're not that math teacher you barely spoke to. They are that person in your life, whether it's your coach or maybe someone who you thought was an anti-mentor, turns out to be an anti-mentor, but somebody who should be your cheerleader, somebody who should be in your corner saying, you got this, you got this. And so you just keep coming back to them because society tells you, oh, that's my mom or that's my coach. They should be saying, I got this. And they're just giving you the opposite message. And it's because of, you know, we come back largely because of societal messages and what I talk about in the book, which is intermittent reinforcement. You know, it's just so powerful and it makes us keep coming back for more, even though we know we shouldn't.
Yeah, I was going to mention intermittent reinforcement, which is for those not familiar, you defined it as, you know, they're not going to be unsupportive or toxic all the time. Every once in a while, they're going to be like, you know, great pitch, or that was a, you know, great job on that spelling test, or, you know, great presentation you did. And so you're going to be waiting and expecting that that's the positive feedback you're going to get every time. But the other 90% of the time it's unsolicited criticism or, you know, destructive feedback. And you're like, wait a minute, I thought we were in a relationship where you gave me positive feedback and were kind to me.
Oh, it's horrible because you crave it. You know, you crave it and then they give it to you. And you're like, oh man, maybe it's going to be different. And then maybe sometimes they give it to you twice. You're like, this is the moment. And they don't change most of the time. I mean, once in a while, when you start laying down unbelievable boundaries, anti-mentors will back off, but it's pretty rare. Most of the time you sort of have to go through this grieving process of, oh, I'm never going to get what I need from this person. And that's so sad because we all want that from the person who should be our mentor. But sometimes we have to grieve and let go of that and just realize that's we have to go somewhere else. And I think that's actually one of the hardest things for most people in our lives.
hardest, and I would also say most important, right? Like when you finally realize that you've got to go through that grief and not succumb to it, but allow it.
Mm-hmm.
And like letting go of those expectations, releasing not only your own expectations, but releasing the other person. From the expectations of being something they cannot ever be to you.
And they keep doing, I mean, it's so interesting. It's intermittent reinforcement. I actually went on a blind date, a Bumble date with a guy who works in a casino. And he talked about how they use intermittent reinforcement to keep people in their seats and continue to gamble, even though they're losing. And it's, you know, it's why the house always wins, because once in a while you get that delicious payday, and anti-mentors are really good at giving you exactly what you need once in a while. And then just, you know, as Maya Angelou said, people will peck you to death like ducks. You know, they keep pecking at you the rest of the time, and then you get that big payday. And that's why rats will sit there and pull a lever until they starve. You know, so it's very, very powerful. And I think it's one of the journeys of our lives isn't just getting rid of the anti-mentor in our life or neutralizing them, but identifying them. You know, that's the hardest part, because you just don't want to believe that it is the person who you keep hoping one day will be your mentor.
And I'm so glad you brought that up, because it brings up a good point of one of the questions I wanted to ask you about, which you speak with such authority in your book. And then you told what I thought was a very humbling story of like, I know all this stuff, I practice all of this stuff, and yet this will still happen to me. And I'm talking about Brad, right? You dated this guy who we'll call Brad. Brad. Because people don't show up in their full, anti-mentor personality at first. They're going to peck you to death, right? But slowly over time, they're not going to peck you all at once at first. So I'd love if you could kind of tell me the short version of the Brad story and the resulting emotion that you felt.
Oh, that was the worst. That was just the worst. You know, I call him Chad, so forgive me if I accidentally call him Chad during this, but I called him Brad in the book, and then it was too late to change it to Chad. I thought Chad was just more annoying. So, but you know, I met this guy, he was amazing. He was perfect. He was literally perfect. I mean, I have a crooked pinky, which it comes from some trauma in my own life. He had a crooked pinky, you know, he loved Billy Joel. I love Billy Joel. Everything I wanted, he was the dude. And I just thought, wow, this is the most wonderful thing. I finally found the perfect guy. And I didn't know it, that I had not done the research on, I'd heard people say, oh, my ex-boyfriend's a sociopath or a malignant narcissist. And I thought, everybody says their exes are malignant narcissists and sociopaths. I wasn't very empathetic, because sometimes when it doesn't happen to you, you don't get it. And then, you know, I didn't realize about love bombing. I didn't realize about all these things. Slowly, ever so slowly, he started just pecking me to death like a duck. And it got so bad that at one point toward the end, and I tell the story in the book, he said I could come to his house, but I was not to speak to him because he had to do lawn work. I had to be quiet, and I would just sit there the whole time, but I wasn't allowed to work because he wanted me to be available in case he felt like talking to me. And, you know, for a while I was like, oh, maybe I should do that. And then I thought, what has happened to me? I'm a feminist. I know about this stuff. I've read all the literature. I've done the research. I've heard the stories. How did I land here? And that was the beginning of the end. But the fact that I almost did it, I almost went to his house and sat silently at his counter on his kitchen while he did lawn work, waiting for him. You know, it was a power move. And I later realized he was just an unbelievable, he was actually kind of a sociopath. And it was interesting. My daughter, who's one of the most wonderful people in the world, said, well, Mom, you know, people who are sociopaths have a mental disorder. They lack empathy, and you should feel bad for him that he was born without that. And at the time I was like, I don't care. And in truth, you know, I'm not going to go into that question, but what it really showed me was you can know all the things and you can still goof up. And the most important thing for me is to forgive myself when that happens and to realize that I'm a human being and I can know all the things and I can still mess up once in a while. And that's just because I actually have flesh and blood and breathe air.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really related to that story. I didn't have that in a romantic sense, but I had it in a with a family relationship where I fell into a conversational trap with somebody and like was trying to, you know, do all the work and, you know, all the tools that I had, every tool I had, they just, whoosh, and I was, and at the end of it, I wasn't mad at the person. I was mad at myself. I was so angry with myself. Like, how could I have fallen into the trap? I know better. And I should have better boundaries. And I let my guard down and right. It took a little bit of work and a little self-compassion to just be like, it's okay.
Like, okay. Yeah. And I think so much of it is forgiving yourself, because if you don't, then you are really in trouble, because then you're going to do it again. Because then you can't really examine what happened. You know, you're just, you know, seeped in shame. And I think for people who are empathetic, and I think of it as like you go to a football field, right? And you have been told that everybody's supposed to come in bathing suits. So you're like, cool, we're going to play touch football in bathing suits. We're all going to be super respectful. And the other team shows up in their full gear and starts crushing you. And you're just so shocked that they broke all the rules of humanity that you just keep trying to play the game, because you can't believe, you're like, am I, you know, you gaslight yourself. You think, are they really in full padding? I thought we had an agreement. And, you know, part of the journey is to be able to look at someone and go, oh, they're cheating. They're not playing fair. I can walk off this field right now. I don't need to participate with someone who's not going to play fair.
Absolutely. I don't like these rules. I'm out of here.
Yeah. I like the rules. They broke them. Later.
Yeah, exactly.
Not necessary for me to stay here. And that's another thing is, I think we all don't, the cut and run thing feels bad, but sometimes that's the best way to win, is not to play.
Absolutely. So I want to talk a little bit about physicality, because you talk a lot of it about it in your book and how it relates to your self-worth. And so we're talking about kind of claiming space and self-worth and physicality. And I love, there's so many great illustrations and things and actual exercises in the book as well. So I would love if you can talk kind of through the 5 contributing skill sets and how they contribute to how you take up space.
Yeah. So what I realized when I was recovering from my accident is that I kept looking for that one thing that allowed women to come in the room and just claim their space. Cause I thought, you know, life's easy. I'm going to get the one thing. And of course it's never that easy. It's never that simple. There were 5 things. I found that women who had these 5 qualities, not that they mastered them, but they were mindful of trying to be aware of them, really knew how to live a life where they claim space. And what they were first physicality and voice. They showed up with their voice and their body. Even if they were afraid, they did it anyway. The second one was they knew how to build community, and that includes getting anti-mentors out of their life so they could build healthy communities. The third one is they didn't let their past crush them and inform their present in a toxic way. And, you know, I always hear people say, oh, you know, you should just get over it. Get over whatever it is. I didn't find that that's true for the women who were really doing well. And I don't think it is true. I think that we have these huge boulders that we carry around with us. They're huge and they're painful. And we just work on them and we whittle them down and we whittle them down until they become these little pebbles in our pocket. And we put them in our pocket and we touch them and we go, oh, I survived that. I'm going to be okay. Look what I learned. You know, that's me. And women who could carry those pebbles and get them small, but never let go of them and always realize that's a part of who they were, did very, very well. The next one was women who could fend off aggressors, who knew when to cut and run, who knew how to protect themselves. And finally, women who approached the world in terms of their relationships in an intersectional way, women who didn't just hang out with women who looked like them. Because when you hang out with women who are different than you and you try to raise up all women, not just women in your demographic, not only do you make the world better, but you learn so much about yourself and you become a better person for it. And women who could do those 5 things were really, really good. And the physicality and voice stuff is obviously incredibly near and dear to my heart, because although I went to school for political science, I then later went to school for acting and taught acting for 20 years. And it was all physicality and voice. And so I got to become quite an expert on how the way you move your body in space influences how people see you.
And I want to ask you a question based on the people that you've worked with and just your own experience. I was discussing this with my partner this weekend, the the story I have about the people that I admire and the way that they walk into rooms, right? And I think of, you know, speakers and people that get paid to go into rooms and speak to large groups of people. And I was like, I have the story that every room they walk into is just like that. Like they've been paid to be there, and their attention and their physicality and their voice attracts all of this attention. And I was like, I want to see them at like the school pickup line. I want to see them, you know, casually talk to people in the grocery store line, or like these forced dinner parties where they're just their date or their partner's extra plus one. Right, a wedding where they don't know anyone, right? Like we only get to see them in the scenarios in which they've been called to action to perform as this person. So what do those people have in common with us? And what do they look like in those different situations?
Well, I mean, look, anybody who's doing speaking for their job likes to be up in front of a crowd and hopefully likes to teach. I love to teach. Teaching is my passion. So, you know, I like to be in front of people and talk. But I think part of claiming space, which goes to the intersectionality piece and goes to building community, is that sometimes you have to learn when to step back and when you shouldn't be in the spotlight. And if you're somebody who likes it, you have to be, you know, just like some people have to mindfully take up space when they give a speech, people who like to be the center sometimes need to step back and make sure that they're letting other people be the center. And that has to be a mindful decision. I don't think it comes naturally. If you're a performer, I mean, I hang out with a lot of performers and we're very big and we love to be out there. But, you know, I also think that people in acting tend to be very emotionally intelligent and tend to know when to step back and give someone else the spotlight.
It's a really good point that you made. I'm really glad that I asked, because you're right. It is, if you have to be the center of attention in every room, that's your narcissist.
Right? Yeah.
Like you're not reading the room. You're lacking a little bit of empathy. You don't know how the context might need to shift away from you always being in the center of attention, right?
Right. Because it's not always about you.
Exactly.
Sometimes you're not the star. I mean, it's so funny because we're all the star of our own movie, right? We are all walking around in this movie and everybody around us is, you know, is our supporting person. And I think the problem comes in when suddenly you believe that everyone is a supporting person in their own head, when really everyone in their own head is in their own movie as the star. And you have to realize that everybody's starring in their own movie. And sometimes you're the supporting player in their movie, and that's okay.
Speaking of that, you have a really great section of different types of responses. So every single section of the book, there's posture and voice and physicality and messaging, phrasing. And so there's lots of sections of the book where you're giving people different versions of phrasing kind of strength-wise, right? Like you can respond no, you could respond no with this type of phrase, or you could respond no with like a super aggressive type if they're not picking up the messages. And so I'd love if you gave us some examples of like beginner, right? Like somebody's just for the first time trying to assert themselves with somebody and not get like run over. Or, you know, I have two young teenage boys. And so we've been talking about what mansplaining is a lot.
Right. And so when I was reading cartoons,
I did. I was like, so, you know, just be aware in rooms when this is happening and here's how you can respond. And right. And so, yeah, how does somebody begin to recognize that they're not, it's because it's both internal and external, right? You have to recognize you're being less present and you're not taking, you need to claim the space that you want and also call out or deal with when people, because you can get big and you can get loud or you can get all these, you can use all these tactics and it might not deter somebody else in the room at all, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think the number one thing to start with, it seems kind of basic, but before you start to throw no's around, I love the word no. I think it's beautiful. We should all say no more. One of my friends, his wonderful guy, said, this year, my whole goal, my New Year's resolution is to say no to everything. And I was like, that's kind of weird. And he's like, no, believe me, it's going to be the best year. because you know, he overcommitted a lot. So he was trying to say no more. And I think the first thing, though, is learning to not apologize for your point of view. To make sure that there are two reasons to apologize. You know, when you've done something wrong, it's good to apologize. or when there's something you really, really want to do, but you just can't do it. So I'm so sorry. I know you helped me move last weekend, but my kid is incredibly sick, so I can't help you. I feel terrible. You know, those are good reasons to apologize. But women apologize, you know, okay, so I'm sorry, but my opinion is, like, why do we have to apologize for our opinion? We don't. And so I think that the first step for a lot of women, instead of saying, I'm sorry, is saying, thank you. So that sounds a little odd, but so instead of saying, you know, I'm so sorry for my messy house, say, oh, thanks so much for coming into my messy house. It's so cozy today. I haven't cleaned it yet. Like, or thanks so much for waiting for me. I really appreciate it, as opposed to sorry, I'm late. Or if your kid walks into the Zoom, don't say, oh, I'm so, so sorry my kid walked in. Say, thanks for tolerating my kid coming in. I really appreciate it. Or thanks for being supportive. And I think that sort of switches the whole paradigm. It switches it from I did something wrong to I appreciate you. And that also gives the other person the opportunity to say, you're welcome. Whereas sorry makes them have to take care of you and say, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay, as opposed to, oh, no problem. I was happy to do it, which is more positive for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. I've used the thanks for your patience with my children many times in the last 3 years, as my office is at home. And sometimes the kids have clothes on, sometimes they don't. So definitely saying thanks for your understanding at this completely inappropriate obstruction. And I've noticed something else that right. I do is when people bump into me, I'll say, excuse me, like as if I'm at fault. Like, why did I just say excuse me? Yeah, which is another version of
it happens
I'm sorry.
All the time. All the time to women. Yeah. Like someone runs into you. Oh, excuse me. No, they ran into you. It's like I had someone on an airplane the other day. I was flying first class. I was very fortunate enough to be flying first class. First class has like this much space between the two people, right? This is not like an elbow to elbow thing. This dude managed to like put his hand over all the way. And I just was like, no. So this happens to me all the time. Just went in a little armrest and just pushed. Didn't say anything. Kept looking at me like, what are you doing? And I was like, trying to get 50%.
Just take up space. 50%. I'm entitled to. Thank you. Yeah.
Taking up my 50% of the space. And that's the thing that's so interesting to me is a lot of times when women try to claim 50% of the space, people lose it. They can't believe it. They think it's crazy and terrible. And, you know, I'm always like, well, what is that saying about you that you think you're entitled to 65%? You know, nobody is. We all should be taking our fair share. And I, you know, that's what is so interesting with the response to feminism, because feminism is literally just the belief that women should have equal rights and opportunities. And people are like, are you a feminist? And I'm like, are you not? Like, that seems strange. So I think that's an uphill battle for women, is they are taught that they deserve less and their value is less. And, you know, and that they should be applauding men for taking the thing that they really deserve. And I think it's so important for us to make sure we're not doing that without
even,
apology.
Yeah. Applauding men for surrendering what was not theirs, right? Like, they want awards for, you know, giving back the 20% of the armrest. They were, well, aren't you grateful? And you're like, no, actually, just
oh yeah,
getting what I deserved.
Totally. I mean, that should be a given. It's just sort of like when, you know, somebody will say, oh, did you see the way that white person really stood up for that Black person? Wasn't that amazing? I'm like, well, I mean, it's amazing that other people weren't doing it. That's amazing. You know, I am very happy that person did it. I guess it's hard given our culture, but it should be a given, you know, that if something is going on and that you feel as a white person or a man that it's safe to intervene, that you're not going against the will of the person who's the target, that you step in, you know, but we don't do that enough, which is actually why people get rewarded for it. It's just not, it doesn't happen enough and it should happen a lot more.
I want to come back just one more time to kind of the more physical presence kind of stuff where people are in situations, meetings, at work, with their family. And what is your top tip about the way that someone is speaking and holding themselves in a room physically?
I think the main thing, the number one thing I think that women need to do, well, not need to do, that is useful, is not affirmation nod, not do. So when somebody is going after you, often women will go, And, you know, it's like, you don't need to make someone feel comfortable for making you uncomfortable. You can let them be uncomfortable with the fact that they're going after you. You can not move your face. You can drop your smile and you can just look at them and let them understand that it's not okay. We're so trained to make people feel comfortable that we literally care for them while they are trying to eviscerate us at times. And I think that's the first step, is just not doing that. You can let uncomfortable silence hang there. You don't even need to answer right away. In fact, when someone's going after you, our tendency is to jump in right away and try to defend ourselves or prove them wrong. I found it's much more powerful if you take a moment and you just don't say anything and you look at people and you give yourself the time you need to respond how you want to. Men do it all the time. They stop and they pause and you know, just to stop and pause and look and then answer. I think that's a really great way of saying, you know, we can have a discussion. I'm not always doing the right thing. You can disagree with me, but you can't treat me badly. And if you do, I'm not going to be a caretaker in this situation.
Right. You can't treat me badly. And then I get to counsel your feelings about how I feel after you've done that.
Exactly. Exactly. I don't need to take care of your feelings about your feelings. That's on you, you know? And that's not to say, I mean, I think empathy and kindness, there's just not enough of it in the world. And it's so important. Not, you know, niceness, which I talk about the difference in my book between nice and kind, but kindness is just undervalued, underrated, and real disagreement where we talk about the issue that we're disagreeing about rather than eviscerating the other human being is really just, there's just not enough of that. But if someone's going after you and fighting dirty, you just don't need to care for them.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's the phrase, I'm not sure who came up with it in the beginning, but it was clear is kind, right? We can be clear and still be kind. And that doesn't mean that we're nice. It means clarity is also kind, and it doesn't have to come with all the platitudes and caretaking that often go along with it, especially for women.
Absolutely. I mean, my partner now, who I've now been dating for almost 2 years, is, we always joke, that he's definitely on the spectrum. And we talk about how that sort of impacts everything. And the really interesting thing for me is that, and his parents were also therapists, and they were very much into like clear, direct communication. And as much as I love that, it still shocks me sometimes the way he's just like, my needs are this. I'd like to know your needs and then we'll figure it out. At the same time, I never worry where he stands. I never wonder. I wonder what he really thinks. If he thinks a thing, he's going to tell me that thing. And what a gift that is, to know exactly where you stand, as opposed to that insecure feeling we often get with people where they said this, but is that what they really think? And I think that's the gift we give people when we're straightforward. It's the gift of the truth, which is really probably one of the more powerful gifts that we have as human beings to give other people.
Absolutely. And just in thinking about our relationships in general, being truthful with ourselves first and then being responsible with that truth with the people that we're in relationship with, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's hard. I find it really hard because I am a recovering people pleaser. So I want to be always taking care, you know, managing. And it just doesn't serve anybody.
Absolutely. In a complete agreement, recovering people pleaser as well on this end of the conversation. Eliza, I have really liked talking to you. How can people find out more about you and your work?
Well, you can go to elizavancourt.com. There is no U in court, E-L-I-Z-A-V-A-N-C-O-R-T. And you can learn a lot more about me there. And there are links to my media, and I have a community that I'm, a really wonderful community that is on my listserv, and I get all kinds of questions, and I love that. That's my favorite. People on my listserv reaching out to me saying, hey, can you talk about this? Can you talk about that? There's really a community of women out there who want to claim space, and men who want to support it, and people of all genders. So that's kind of the thing I'm most excited about on my website.
Fantastic. Thanks again so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.